Hello and welcome to Talking Heads. I'm Matt McCordon here in the studio, and on Skype we have Sam Barnett and we have Scott Payne with us tonight, and we'll be, as we always do, discussing the issues of the week. First up, San Bernardino, California shootings have now been declared an act of terrorism by the FBI, but they haven't attached them to a terror cell. We'll be looking at the implications as this fallout continues. The United Kingdom has voted to bomb Syria. The United States refuses Syrian refugees. This happened a couple weeks ago. We'll be discussing the implications of that as a Taliban shootout has occurred in Pakistan, potentially leaving the leader of the Taliban in Pakistan dead. Turks shoot down a Russian fighter jet, this we know, but we'll be looking at the diplomatic fallout, as well as U.S. Special Forces beginning to enter Iraq. Donald Trump has attacked a New York Times reporter, but has kept his lead as candidates battle over national security, and Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has offered to donate 99% of his assets. Stay with us as we discuss the top topics on campaign 2016, national and global politics, and foreign affairs on this, the 4th of December, 2015. Right now, it's 6:01. All right, hello. Welcome to Talking Heads. And we're going to start out with issue number one, as we're now being joined by Shamita Rahman and Urbija Rishi in the studio. Glad you all could make it. Forgive the banging of a stool. Right, so first up on the issue list is the San Bernardino, California shootings. Sam, why don't you start us off on this while we get situated in the studio?
I mean, obviously, this is like kind of the major domestic issue right now in the news, you know, front page, top story, all of that. Kind of the details are still not completely worked out. They're still kind of working on a lot of the background. It's very much still an ongoing investigation. Mm-hmm. But as we know, a married couple went and attacked a Christmas party of, what is it, the city human resources?
Yeah, it was a disability center.
Yeah.
They're having a health commissioner's party.
Yeah.
Health workers' party, rather.
There, yeah. And what, 14 deaths is the total?
Yeah, I think that's what we're sitting at now, 14.
14 deaths, yeah, 14. So obviously kind of a tragedy, and now with the kind of revelation that this is being considered a terrorist attack, there's kind of information that the female attacker, posted a Facebook message pledging allegiance to ISIS. And there are apparently kind of phone calls and kind of email exchanges that went on with other individuals who are kind of on watch lists and things like that. So a lot of investigating still needs to be done, but this appears to have been a terrorist attack. Mm-hmm. And with all kind of the implications that brings, because that very quickly changed kind of the – because the initial argument was it brought up the whole kind of gun control issue. But now kind of it's kind of changed. Once you bring terrorism up, that changes kind of the rhetoric. And so now we're into a new kind of dialogue.
Mm-hmm. So we're still getting a little bit situated in here, but so let's talk about how this has transformed from a gun rights debate into all of a sudden a national security and immigration debate. That's been rather particular interest, how quickly this has changed on the ground here. So we were originally looking at the usual post-mass shooting in the United States debate with calls for more gun control, and now that's sort of been flipped on its head with suddenly we're looking at, is there the potential of ISIS sympathizers in the United States?
Well, I mean, the suspect, I think, I can't really quite remember his name, but... Saeed Farouk, yes. Yeah. He is an American-born citizen. However, I mean, to put it frankly, he's Muslim, and so was his wife, who is also the second suspect in the shooting.
They're both Pakistani ethnically.
So, I mean, of course it would bring precedence to discuss an issue with immigration.
Were they born and raised in the U.S. though?
No,
she wasn't.
Yeah, she was brought in with a fiancé visa in 2000,
They met online and then,
Yeah, oh, I think it was either a dating network or a mail order bride sort of thing.
No,
yeah,
I don't think it was. Sure.
I thought they met in Saudi Arabia and when during the pilgrimage. Yeah, that's what I read.
They met during Hajj.
From what it sounds, though, she appears to be the more radical one. She's kind of she seems to be more of kind of the unknown quality.
I mean, she's
because everybody says that he was kind of just a quiet guy, but then that nobody would expect it from him, and then she's kind of the new, the new kind of variable on the scene, and that seems to kind of changed everything.
That does make sense because you know the reports said that he stormed out of the compound after having you know some sort of verbal altercation with someone, and then in the next 20 minutes he comes back with rifles with his wife, and something like this like I think the chief of police there said this is something that wasn't just a spur of the moment thing. Is something that was planned.
Yeah, and there's the whole fact where they left their new like I think they're like 2-year-old with their relatives like the week before. And like and I think the man he'd stopped going to the weekly prayers at their local Islamic center. So I mean, it all points to the fact that there was a certain level of planning that went into it, contrary to what their lawyer is saying right now. I mean, the most recent reports that came out of CNN, where the lawyer was saying that, oh, this is like a absolutely atrocious like comparison, where he was like, oh, this is like the Sandy Hook school shooting. We can't really make allegations before the investigation's complete, which is completely terrible because, like, the Sandy Hook case is entirely different. And, I mean, with her post on Facebook, this seems pretty obvious, like, what might have gone down.
All right, so let's talk about policy implications. So, as I mentioned, there are two big specters of things that have been raised here. The first is immigration and national security, and the second is gun control. So let's actually start with gun control, because I think this will get some interesting conversations going. So there are some who are arguing in the wake of this, as is often the case, that greater gun control would have prevented this from happening. Do any of you think this was the case? And if so, state your case. Okay. The resident social democrat has the floor.
I mean, this is one of the few shootings that happened because of where an immigrant, specifically a Muslim immigrant, was the main perpetrator or alleged main perpetrator or whatever. Most of these have been happening by very average Americans, Caucasians and such. So clearly this is an issue of not immigration, but gun control, not because, you know, there's Muslims in the country that these things are happening. These are happening because people are giving out guns, practically.
And like, there's that statistics with Australia where after they implemented their gun laws, like, their mass shooting rates went down significantly, and like, the statistics kind of speak for themselves, and I'm not saying that this would necessarily, like, erase all instances of mass shootings in America, but it'd be a good start.
Sam?
Mm-hmm.
Your response?
Well, I mean, California has some of the strictest gun laws in the United States of America, and that didn't work. I mean, France has very strict gun laws, and we've seen multiple instances this year of people with military-grade automatic weaponry in launching attacks and mass shootings in France. So this is not kind of simply wave the wand and we ban guns and then guns just stop existing and stop kind of entering the country. So this is a very complicated issue, and there are certain scenarios in which kind of there could be stricter gun laws for certain people. Like, I think Hillary Clinton mentioned something about kind of if you're on a no-fly list, you shouldn't be able to buy a gun. And yeah, that's probably that's a reasonable kind of step we could take.
But yes, that would be unconstitutional.
Probably a good idea.
But it would technically be unconstitutional, would it not? I mean, there is no actual right to due process under those no-fly lists, as some of people have been complaining about for years, and frankly, it's an arbitrary decision by the executive, so that would seem to me to fail the Second Amendment test. So that would almost require an amendment to the Constitution if you're taking a strict reading, as I'm sure several justices would.
Have the states do it.
Okay.
And also just kind of, this is a good example, though, of, well, no, we'll save that for later.
We all wait with bated breath. Scott, yeah. Anything you have to add?
I mean, I like, oh, sorry, oops, that was loud. But yeah, I agree with Sam on this matter. It is, California, like, you know, as all my, you know, lovely friends from Texas post their memes on Facebook, as I can tell, yes, oh, the Kermit the Frog sips tea, and California is the strictest gun, has the strictest gun laws in America. But, I mean, as ridiculous as the Republican memes are, you know, they have a point, I guess.
Are we, like, I mean, like, that's the thing, though, like, we can't point all the mass shootings straight to guns, but there's so many other issues. There's mental health, and then there's, I mean, if you want to focus on immigration as well, sure, we can call that an issue, but you'd have to start somewhere, and guns seem to be a good starting point.
But guns are constitutionally protected.
Mm-hmm. And that's a problem.
Other things aren't. Yeah.
And also, this mass shooting incident, specifically like shootings where there's a Muslim or an immigrant involved, this won't be fixed with just gun regulation or with just immigration reform or any of the sort. This is something that needs to come from a more broader legal battle, because this is. Because what would happen if we close our borders? Then there will still be mass shootings by, you know, Americans, not just Caucasians, but, you know, Americans. And then there will be, if we just ban all guns, then there will still be mass shootings, because we can find guns anywhere. There's still gangs, there's still cartels that can bring them into the country. I don't know, this is a bigger problem than I think just two separate legal battles.
To be honest, I don't think this is just a legal battle or just a gun control battle. This goes on to, like, somehow the very fabric of the society here, because people are becoming increasingly desensitized to the fact that there's a mass shooting every few weeks or few months.
Or a few days.
The rate at which things are going.
But also, you can just say that it's being caused by the increased polarization of the American people. Look at the political undertones of these shootings. Someone killed people in a Planned Parenthood because they don't believe in the 3% of abortions at Planned Parenthood. Take care of the it's because of the state that the country is in.
Okay, what are you talking about, social and cultural polarization? Because that's always
I'm talking
been
about
there.
Political polarization. I'm talking about the anger between the left and the right about, I mean, you know, policy reforms, and, you know,
I mean, there's something else here, though. Like, guns have been a part of American society since the beginning. Americans have been shooting each other for a long time.
Yeah.
We've just only decided it's become a major issue fairly recently. There was a time when we glorified such mass shootings, you know, kind of we wrote little kind of, you know, pulp novels about kind of Wild West gunfights and things like that. And they're really fairly similar. If you think about it, I mean, that's part of, it's part of American culture.
Shooting people?
Yeah.
Well,
you have to take the good with the bad.
Well, that's some semblance of culture.
Well, happy we got that out there.
I mean, the sad thing, though, is that it took a colored shooter for it to become a national security issue, and that's when this country will finally start referring to these shootings as acts of terrorism and not just people with mental health problems.
Because you're not acts of terrorism when there's... You have to have... Terrorism denotes a level of organization and a certain intent.
That is very
true. It doesn't
true.
Seem like... Yeah.
I mean, there's a difference between terrorism and what some other shootings are, which are essentially, you know, last ditch, not necessarily intended with the same effect of terrorism. There are more various other motives on that. So I think it might be a bit overbroad to declare every mass shooting as terrorism myself. But let's move into the immigration issue really quickly, and then we'll move forward. So there has been some discussion from certain presidential candidates. If anyone can guess those, you get no prize because they're pretty obvious. But there have been certain suggestions that certain classes of persons be placed on a national registry, which, good luck getting that one through the courts.
Is this, like, Nazi Germany?
But there has been that suggestion. There's also been suggestion in relation to the Syrian refugees. So let's move into the Syrian refugee question. So several U.S. states have, in the last couple of weeks, refused to accept Syrian refugees, despite the obvious federalism question on this, as in the government, and specifically the Congress, has power over immigration and naturalization. Let's look at the action itself. So this is following the Paris attacks. Scott, you want to start us off?
I don't think they have any hopes or intentions of it even passing. I think they just want to make their constituents happy. They know they can't do this.
And like, even if it's passed like federally, I mean, the states still have the right to like cut off funding for refugee resettlement, like resettlement programs and everything. So like, they can always like make it unfavorable for refugees to come in. But then again, if it's passed federally, like, they have to go somewhere, and like, it comes down to where they'll go, because I think Colorado and Delaware and a couple of other states have said they're okay with it, but you can't have like 10,000 potential refugees crowding up those states, which seems, it just seems like a big mess of a situation at this point.
I don't know, I feel like the U.S. naturalization process is already so rigorous. I mean, I think there's like 10 or 15 families that are coming into the U.S. from Syria. And they've all gone through a year-long process of having their backgrounds checked and, like, getting just interviewed and such. So, I mean, it's very unlikely that those specific refugees from Syria would come in here and cause problems, aside from, you know, having trouble adjusting and such.
But I'd say it's almost the fear that this could happen here that is driving these sorts of actions that are being taken. I mean, partly just ignoring the fact that it's a year to 3 year naturalization process on a refugee's visa to be able to get that approved through the system. I mean, you've got fear that's starting to permeate, and there are people who are trying to act on that fear either for their own political capital or because they themselves are afraid of the possibility of terrorist attacks in their states. But I also think it's sort of interesting the fact that these executive actions that some of these governors are taking are, in fact, illegal for the reasons that I've stated. It's arguably illegal under the Constitution for the state to waltz into immigration naturalization. You can't do that. Multiple presidents have said so. So I'm rather surprised that some of these governors, especially some of the more centrist ones, have decided that this would be a good step to take, something that wouldn't make them look like fools in a couple of weeks, which, oh boy, it has. So I'm just sort of interested in that. Sam?
I mean, it's also unconstitutional for the president to sign executive orders and for the Supreme Court to rule on the constitutionality of laws. So, I mean,
we are not getting into a debate on Marbury v. Madison. Please.
But if the federal government once decides to kind of place these refugees, they can always put them in Washington, D.C. if the states do not agree. So,
because Washington, D.C. is well known for its abandoned housing projects, Mr. Barnett?
Yeah, but but they can do it. Washington, D.C. is a federal city. They can
with
put them there.
With virtually no land available in Washington, D.C.
We'll find a spot. Do it. I mean, they can do it if they want to. They can just kick other people out of their homes. I mean, the government's done worse things before.
Well, I'm not entirely certain that would fall under the principles of eminent domain, but, and just ignoring the fact that it costs something like $60,000 to get a one-room apartment in D.C., I mean, there is a certain faith and credit with a refugee visa in the United States. I mean, if you're admitted to the United States under the Constitution, you're admitted to all of them, not just some. I mean, that's one of the basic tenets of the Constitution, one of the things the Articles of Confederation messed up. So in that sense, they do have that power. And ignoring the fact that technically there is no room for executive orders being by themselves legislation, but still, I mean, the federal government does have plenary power on immigration and naturalization. So I'm not entirely certain how that could be withdrawn in this case.
California banned Chinese immigration once upon a time.
Well,
by the rest of the country. I mean, aren't the states supposed to be the the kind of petri dish of democracy? If the states decide that they don't want somebody to come, it's kind of the European Union problem that kind of now carrying over to us. We're having the same issues here.
Except the difference is that the U.S. has uniform INS regulation, the EU does not. That's a real problem with the EU.
The EU wants to, though.
Well, the EU can want to all they want.
The EU wants to just become one big country, so there's also that.
It hasn't worked out well for us.
All right, well, let's move forward into the Taliban shootout in Pakistan. So, Sam, you mentioned you've been following this one a little bit more closely than I have. So how about some background info?
So the Taliban, the longtime kind of Taliban leader, Mullah Omar, has recently been announced to have been dead. He died, I think, in 2013, but the Taliban didn't say so until very recently. And so his successor, by the name of Mullah Mansour, kind of had the acceptance of most of kind of the Afghan Taliban, but there were various kind of factions and kind of other warlords and leaders who disputed his kind of succession. And there was a meeting held in Pakistan amongst senior kind of Taliban leaders, I guess it's some kind of like sit down to kind of iron these problems out. And a kind of quarrel erupted, and then a shootout erupted. And in the gunfire, apparently Mullah Mansour, the head of the Taliban, was seriously injured and, according to some reports, actually killed. And if that is true, then the Taliban is probably going to splinter even further, which again kind of is significant for a couple of reasons, because it hurts kind of the ability to kind of negotiate with the Taliban, since the Taliban would no longer be kind of a single entity under the control of one leader, as the Afghan government is attempting to negotiate with the Taliban. But if the Taliban splinters into groups of warlords, then we're kind of starting to look at the situation where the next largest kind of militant group in fighting the government in Afghanistan is going to be ISIS. And we don't want to negotiate with ISIS, do we? So there could be some very interesting kind of fallout from this development if Mullah Mansour actually was killed. It's kind of interesting to hear kind of pundits and security experts from the West kind of say, you know, kind of, we hope this guy doesn't die, this leader of the Taliban, this horrible organization. We hope he doesn't die so that we can actually negotiate. So it's very interesting.
Anyone on the panel have any thoughts on it?
Apparently, the Taliban spokesperson said that this is all lies and it's a conspiracy by the Afghan intelligence forces to spread lies about the Taliban, clearly.
Well, I mean, that would be their response, because this would look really bad if they...
But the guy...
years ago and they didn't tell us until now.
Yeah, but the guy who was supposed to be Omar's replacement is supposed to not be very widely accepted by the Taliban factions.
Well, that's what their meeting was for. And we saw how that turned out. Apparently, he isn't widely accepted.
Oh, man, Scott just found a great quote.
This is beautiful. During the discussion, some senior people developed differences and they opened fire on each other, end quote. Yes. Yes, I disagree with you here. Like, you know,
AK-47.
Eat this bullet. Very civilized. Very civilized.
Oh, but please,
let me get
stop.
Your point through, I guess.
Well, pardon the pun, but
They disagree with Barack Obama's notion that violence doesn't solve anything.
Yeah.
And Gandhi's.
And there's the NRA's next argument.
Yeah.
Well, I think the diplomatic implications of this are quite interesting that you touched on, Sam. I mean, the fact that, number one, they're so disorganized that this sort of thing would happen is rather surprising for a group that once ran a country. But the fact that this has occurred is, I think you touched on exactly the right note. This is not good for any sort of negotiating process. And if the Taliban splinters off, it's going to be that much more difficult, let's face it.
And you do have ISIS. ISIS is gaining momentum in Afghanistan.
And that is worrying. That is a problem.
Oh, but wouldn't that just worry the Taliban into some more cohesion?
Probably not. It could actually lead them to splinter off and for some factions to start joining the ISIS itself.
Yeah, ISIS pays better than the Taliban. Oh,
their salary, okay, well, their package, better package.
Well, I doubt anyone was talking about 401 and medical plans here, but...
Well, ISIS does have free health care, though. There's that.
Yeah, North America doesn't have that.
Yeah.
And oil money allegedly funneled through Turkish sources.
Allegedly through Turkey, yeah. According to Putin.
Should we get to that point now?
What a perfect segue. So... About a week ago, I want to say, Turks shot down a Russian fighter jet, as they allege it went through their space. Now, this has led to, obviously, a great deal of diplomatic squabbling. Cliff Notes version is that Russians say, no, we didn't. The Turks say, yes, you did. And, interestingly, NATO's kept their mouths shut for most of this, which I've heard more than one person say that that might indicate that there might be some truth to the Russian claims here. So let's just... go around about this and the diplomatic implications. I mean, it's obvious tensions between the U.S. and Russia are still quite a bit there over a multitude of different things, mostly Syria and the Ukraine. But the fact that one of our, let's face it, proxy actors in NATO of Turkey has shot down a Russian fighter and has managed to substantially spook the international community is quite substantial, I think. Floor is anyone's.
This is just coming back to Putin's State of Russia speech that he does, the one that he does annually every year. I think this happened.
State of the Federation.
State of the Federation. Okay. Oh my God. Okay. So in the speech, he was like going on about mostly about how he wants to like the whole war on terrorist aspect thing, which like frankly seems odd coming from Putin because like you can't want to save the Western world while antagonizing it constantly. And there's also the fact that this is the interesting bit that he kept saying all these things, but he mentioned the word ISIS like only once or twice, which makes me think how much of what the threats that he was passing on that, like saying on that speech, was somewhat of a double entendre going to kind of look at Turkey, which he also addressed. And he went on to say a couple of very threatening things, like in terms of like how they're not going to stand for any injustices that are thrown, and like essentially Putin is not going to take anything from anyone. And
I mean, that's always been his stance. No matter what happens, he's never going to take anything from anyone. And, you know, his reaction is usually very...
And, like, it's interesting, military. The Crimea thing, too, because he didn't bring it up once in the entire, like, speech, and I don't think that's even a priority to him at this point.
Mm-hmm. He's bored with it. He needs something
In the long term, it is, but I think he doesn't feel that the status of the Crimea as part of Russia is kind of threatened anymore. We're obviously
it
not
really
going
isn't.
To, we're not going to do anything about it. He won. No, he won that round. Yeah, Crimea round goes to Putin.
Yeah.
All cards, too.
Nobody's going to help
soon,
Ukraine.
The Ukraine and then Estonia and, you know, then everything. He gets to rebuild his empire soon.
I'm pretty sure that's not going to happen for a number of reasons.
Like, and the whole fact that he, like, outright accused...
If he sticks around for long enough, maybe.
Like, I think it's, like, pretty interesting.
Mecha Putin coming alive.
I mean... Going slightly back to the whole Turkey thing, like, I think it's really interesting that he accused the Turkish president of profiting from, like, Syrian oil money, like, quite directly, and like that in itself is a pretty intense accusation.
But hasn't
but
that
is
been
it wrong?
But hasn't that been speculated for quite a long time now?
Yeah, it has. Yeah. I mean, the Turkish president isn't exactly like.
he's not the most commendable human being.
Allegedly.
Well, I mean, he arrests like doctors for making a Gollum meme about him. And
allegedly.
So, you know, allegedly.
But yeah, he isn't the most like upstanding citizen, so to say.
What, in college, didn't he allegedly write some kind of play or something about how, like, Jews, Freemasons, and Catholics are conspiring to destroy Turkey or something,
something
like
that?
He's not a...
That sounds about right, as a Catholic, you know.
But,
well,
I mean, neither is Putin.
Well, I think the commentary on these remarks is sort of interesting. Again, there was someone had mentioned that... can't remember who, several people, actually, had mentioned that if, in fact, the Russian fighter had crossed into Turkish space for longer than the internationally mandated time under international air law, then, well, the United States probably would have had either the NTSB or the DOD come out with projections that showed exactly that. But we have sort of sat on our hands on this. So I'm starting to wonder if Putin
what?
Say again?
The Russian incursion was supposed to have been 17 miles. There's this little, like, strip of Turkish territory that juts into Syria that's 17 miles long, and the Russians flew over that. So in like kind of, you know, a sonic, you know, jet fighter, that's like a matter of seconds.
Oh well, yeah, you know? I mean,
and
that's the allegation,
that's
though,
what
but
the
fact,
Turkish, that's what the Turkish radar images show.
But the fact that we haven't released our own radar images, or any other country in the region for that matter, is somewhat interesting. Because I would have thought that if we would have had that data, and we probably do, and it would have benefited our own case, or at least our NATO allies' case, it would have been out there on day one, but it's not.
And isn't Erdogan also using the justification for the shooting of saying that the Russians have been targeting the Turkmen people who are found in Turkey?
Which sounds very similar to another kind of world leader's kind of actions against people that threaten natives of his own country,
yeah.
Right? You know, like in the Ukraine, maybe, you know?
Oh god.
But I mean, it's the problem is Turkey is kind of the least integrated member of NATO. In some ways, of all kind of the NATO members that aren't the United States, Turkey has benefited the most from NATO because it gave it an increased kind of standing, access to high level kind of military technology and training, prestige, and Turkey is only a member of NATO because of its strategic position in the world.
Well, right, we used to have nukes there.
We had nukes in it because it's right across the Black Sea from Russia. It bordered the old territory of the USSR and the Caucasus. You can close off the Black Sea from the Mediterranean. And I mean, that's been part of kind of the Western European strategy for isolating Russia since basically the Russian Empire began, is that you keep the Russians out of the Mediterranean. You keep them from having access to the oceans. That's how you neutralize them.
I'm just thinking
that
like
won't
to...
stop Putin's subs in the Baltic.
I'm just thinking
he'll be roaming around. But go on.
Nah, it's fine.
Well said, everyone.
I mean, I feel like if there was something actually wrong that Russia had done, NATO would be on it at this point. Either NATO thinks that it's not worth quibbling with Russia right now, because of, you know, the entire Middle East situation, or Turkey might be lying.
I mean, call this a rare day when this happens. There's a blue moon out, but I tend to agree with Erbijah on this. I think that's a fairly viable explanation when you look at the balance of the facts.
I have fun.
Yeah.
Like, sorry, go on.
All right.
No.
Go on.
Someone go.
Okay, I was just going to say, like, I have a fun Putin quote from, like, the speech where he made a little jab at the Americans, where he was like, "We know why that happened. We know who wanted to replace objection. Okay, sorry.
Do you want me to?
Yeah, just read it out. Sorry.
I don't know. You just gave me a...
Oh, goodness.
Sorry. Yeah.
We know who... Okay. We know who wanted to replace objectionable regimes, brutally imposing their own rules. Oh, yeah. There you go. Well, I mean...
There's this
if that doesn't sound like America, then what does?
Yep. That's light.
I mean, he's right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if, you know, if we stayed out of a lot of places, you know.
It's still kinder but, than last year.
And for the benefit of the 7 security services listening into this, there is only one person in the room with a Russian passport, or at least at one point. So,
did you actually ever even have a Russian passport? Did you need one when you were 5?
No, I can claim one.
You can
one
claim
if
one.
If I want to, but like,
you can claim dual citizenship.
Why are we talking about this?
Just to
you're a Muslim
you.
And a Russian? Oh my goodness.
Stop! And
oh,
radio!
Russia has a pretty decent population of Muslims.
Okay, well, tell you what. We're going to move
Chechnya,
on to
Chechnya, but they're not really friendly with everyone else.
There are other places in Russia.
There are other
places. Are there? Oh, interesting.
Yeah. You know, like that big chunk
Chechnya
of land.
Chechnya is just the one where they shoot people.
Oh goodness. Well, so we don't get pulled off air in the next 10 minutes. Coming up on the program. Coming up on Talking Heads, we'll be looking at the U.S. Special Forces beginning to go into Iraq. I've heard one person on this panel, I'll give you one guess who, call it mission creep. Facebook CEO Zuckerberg has offered to donate 99% of his assets. Publicity stunt or actual philanthropy, we'll see. And we'll also be taking a look at the campaign field with Donald Trump doing Donald Trump things, as one could well predict. This is Talking Heads right here in the studio. It is now 6:36 with Matt McCord, Shemaita Rahman, Irva Jerishi, Sam Barnett, and Scott Payne. Okay, so let's take a little trip sideways into Iraq. So the United States has begun to commit special forces to Iraq to fight ISIS. So boots on the ground being out of the question seems rather out the window all of a sudden.
Mission creep.
And by the way, if you won our quiz, you still get nothing. Oh dear. We approve.
Oopsies.
Maybe lost Sam in the crossfire. So I'll try. I'll try and get the feed back. If one of you ladies could go, that would be lovely.
I mean, Obama's been talking about sending people to fight ISIS for a while, so this isn't exactly unprecedented at all. And
I mean, you know, I approve of ground forces, U.S. ground forces being involved in Iraq and Syria. But yeah, I think this is a step forward for the fight against ISIS, and I think that you know, this is a way of putting a, you know, like, you know, this is a way of really defeating ISIS. You can't necessarily complete it, but this is a way of really harming ISIS without losing too many American lives.
And I mean, like, that combined with, like, Britain's recent boat, like, to bomb Syria, like, I mean, like, that along with France and, like, pretty much most of Western Europe agreeing to do this, like, maybe we'll get somewhere with it, like.
Yeah. But what's interesting is that the Iraqi Prime Minister says that any troops from any countries will be considered a hostile act against Iraqi sovereignty.
Oh, boo-hoo, we made your country.
You destroyed their country, would be more appropriate.
Goodness.
Well,
the Iraq invasion was a bad idea.
I'm not gonna deny that, but you know, I mean,
pretty
this
much
is
any involvement in the Middle East was a bad idea, with starting from Afghanistan in the 60s.
I mean, that was all on Russia, though. That was all on Russia.
Well,
that was all Khrushchev.
Well,
I mean, we can start our issues in the Middle East in the 1940s, but like
with Israel and Palestine,
it doesn't, you know. It's just something that won't end, so we might as well just keep it stable, because, you know.
And what a good job you've been doing till now.
Well,
how sparingly
involved the United States
has been.
Yeah, so it would be so much fun if we weren't involved in places like Iran and Iraq, where, you know,
you
Iran
chose
is
to be involved there.
Yeah, and if we weren't involved, we never invaded Iran, but we had issues with them, but if we didn't have,
that sort of thing, then, you know, it could have just been worse. And I'm not saying that dethroning Saddam Hussein was a good idea. That's not a good idea either, because now we have ISIS in Libya, and if we still kept Gaddafi, then maybe there would, I don't know, not be pockets of the Islamic State in North Africa when they get to, you know, rebuild the historical boundaries of their caliphate and, like, ever so slight, you know, increases of territory. It's all going to hell.
At this point, like there's no point in arguing.
Don't worry, Matt, I didn't say anything bad.
I'm still trying to get Sam back. I apologize for the technical difficulties.
Weird. Hear something.
Yeah, I hear him too. Ow.
Okay,
that,
well.
Yeah, that hurt.
Sorry about that. I have Sam on a phone, but the speaker is such that I would say good luck trying to actually hear him on it. We're still trying to get through this. Right. Okay, so I think I have Sam on speaker. Let's see if this works.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
All right.
Apart from this looking...
The first thing I heard was about the caliphate, so... expanding it, so...
Well...
I mean,
Shemita brought up the point that maybe America should just keep its nose out of the Middle East for the entire, you know, time that we've had our nose in the Middle East, but...
That clearly isn't happening anytime soon.
No.
I mean, the Middle East has become too strategically important.
Yeah.
A region at this point in time for anyone to not be involved in it.
I mean, to be fair, the Middle East has always been a strategically important reason. If you go back to the kind of, you know, the Roman Empire, where were the borders of the Roman Empire? Mm-hmm. The Middle East, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The Middle East is a place where kind of empires meet, empires fight. Cultures clash, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
We were just talking about how the Iraqi prime minister doesn't think that having U.S. or any other troops would be a good idea. He would consider them a hostile act against Iraq.
If those troops were of a nation other than Iran, of course...
No, he said that for, like, I think all troops entering.
Sure. Whatever he says.
I mean, sure.
Yeah, because there are a lot of people, you know, listening to what he has to say now.
I mean, he's a puppet prime minister.
Yeah, he does his job so well.
He's a puppet prime minister.
I mean, yeah, Iraq is an Iranian satellite state, basically. Well, the parts of Iraq controlled by the government. Is basically an Iranian proxy state. So the militias, which are the most effective part of kind of the Iraqi military, if you will, armed forces, are funded, trained, led by Iranians. So...
I think what I'm mostly surprised about is in this whole thing is that Obama has been so restrained with, like, placing troops and, like, sending troops to the region, because he's been sending them in, like, 20s and 100s and not, like, more than that. Which is interesting. Looks like a man who doesn't want to end up going to war in his last 6 months.
Yeah, exactly. He doesn't want to get blamed for it, and he promised he wouldn't send American troops back in Iraq. Because if you remember, when he in 2008, his campaign rhetoric was the Iraq war was evil and that we have to get out. And there's no reason to be there. So now, as he eats his words and sends troops back in.
Poor Obama.
Poor Obama. If he wouldn't have gotten out so quickly in the first place, this wouldn't have happened.
All right, well, let's pivot to Britain voting to bomb Syria. So this was rather interesting to watch last night. It was a 10-hour raging Commons debate that led to a whole bunch of domestic political fluff and still is.
It was not close.
I mean, the political commentators are all saying it's a close vote. It was not. It was 400 to 200-ish.
397 to 223.
Something in that area. So that's not at all close. That's a huge majority. But what is interesting is that this caused a big old fight in the Labour Party. The Corbynites, the left wing of the Labour Party, took up the case against airstrikes in Syria for a number of competing interests, one could expect. But much of the old guard of the Labour Party, including, interestingly, the son, I believe, of Tony Benn, a famous left-winger, Hillary Benn, who's sort of in the center left of the party, decided that he would vote against his leader from the front bench, which is normally, that's normally you're one and done. You try that, you're out of the cabinet. In this case, it was called for a free vote after there was a mass threat of resignations from shadow ministers who said, we're out of here if you try and force us to vote this way. So it was a rather contentious debate in the Commons last night. But ultimately, they did vote overwhelmingly to go with it. But ultimately, Jeremy Corbyn looks a little bit weaker today, despite the fact that he just won a by-election with roughly the same vote that Labour got in the most recent election in May of this year. But that's a Labour stronghold seat. But interestingly, looking at that, but then there are a number of MPs who've reported that they've been threatened for voting for the Syrian airstrikes with death threats. So now there's a police detail on a couple of MPs. So it's not, this has been a rather nasty debate, but it's over now. The Brits are starting to bomb.
Mess.
That is a fair point. It is a mess.
Yeah.
But what are your takes on it?
I mean, I never liked the idea of going out and bombing in another country. I think that's just wrong.
Yeah, like when we bombed Nazi Germany.
I mean, they didn't
Godwin's
need to
Law,
be...
41 seconds.
They were going to, like, surrender at some point. Japan didn't need to happen either.
Because we bombed.
So somehow we got into the argument about the H-bomb in Japan. Or rather, A-bomb, rather.
I mean, it's gonna happen. Bombing is kind of the easiest way to kind of exert kind of military force without actually exerting military force. That's kind of the easiest way to do it for these little countries, kind of, these American satellite countries.
They're not American satellite countries. They're countries.
Satellite country.
Is everything that's not the U.S. a satellite country then?
Pretty much.
Oh god.
Well no, but these countries in Europe that have very tiny militaries are American satellites. And we've had this discussion before, that the socialist utopias in Europe only work because they don't spend money on their militaries because of the United States.
And I see looks of sadness from the two socialists / communists in the room.
It is true, though.
And a look of mild satisfaction from the right winger.
What is it, Germany? Germany has 66 fighter jets, tornado fighter jets.
Yeah, I believe so.
Only 29 of them are airworthy at the moment.
Something to that effect.
29. What happens if the Russians invade Europe? God help them. America isn't there to bail them out.
That's going to be fun to watch.
I don't think that's going to happen.
Maybe they'll seduce the Russians happen. With free health.
Oh boy. Sanders supporters, your comments? Never mind.
Sorry, I took my cynical pills today.
Well, apparently it stifled argument on the question. So I think what's rather interesting, though, is the fact that the British political discourse has gotten so nasty to the point that apparently there are now death threats being tossed about between the two different factions of the Labour Party.
Yeah, that's pretty
and
atrocious.
And death threats are coming from the former campaign, the organization that is the former campaign team of Jeremy Corbyn. That's kind of part of this problem. So he's had to distance himself from these people, the loony left, as it were.
Despite the fact that he apparently embodies the loony left. The loony left distancing itself from the loony left-er. Rather interesting dynamic.
It's hard to govern from the loony left.
But, well, let's look at how he's been doing as opposition leader from the loony left, if you will. Or at least just the left. Depending on your stance. The look of dismay I just received was glorious. So, he's now been opposition leader for a couple of months. And suddenly the Conservatives have a 15-point lead over the Labour Party. But, at the same time, there are more members that have been registered for the Labour Party than ever before. So I'm starting to wonder, are we seeing a polarization like we've seen in the United States and many other countries in the past couple of years in British politics? Discounting the fact that UKIP is still sitting on 15% of the vote.
I mean, the scary part in
Britain. Perhaps, but at the same time, the Tory party is a centrist party, really, when you look at it. You know, the vast majority of Tories, if they were American politicians, would be Democrats. So, they're really a centrist party, and they kind of have a governing majority on their own. So, maybe there is some polarization, but at the same time, the party in the center is the one that's getting the votes.
Scott? All right.
Yep.
Sorry, man.
All right, so we've got about 10 minutes left. It's now 6:50 p.m. Let's move into our favorite subject.
Let's talk about Trump and Zuckerberg.
Donald Trump. I want to talk about Donald Trump first. So Donald Trump has recently decided that it would be a good idea to attack a Times reporter and allegedly mock his disability. but strangely enough, yet again, he has found his lead to be ever resilient. And all the candidates in the Light of Paris have started battling one another over national security. Chris Christie yet again attacked Rand Paul, calling him a soft among various other political epithets. Let's take a look at this Trump thing first. I mean, most people with a journalism background to whom I've spoken on this have said that this is absolutely reprehensible, that what Donald Trump did, it is ridiculous. I think the ADA has started to come out against it, as one would expect. But it doesn't seem to dampen Trump's lead any.
I think that's more of an indication of the people of America than it is of Donald Trump.
I think it's more of an indication of the state of America than it is of the American people, where we're at this point.
That's what people expect from Trump. Like, this is what they want, and they're getting what they want. So I don't see why anyone would be complaining.
They want someone who mocks people with disabilities
on an
allegation. They
want someone who'll criticize anything and everything.
And not do anything. At the end of the day, Donald Trump does not have the experience or the knowledge to effectively implement any sort of executive policy.
To be fair, Barack Obama didn't either, but we've had him for 8 years. The country hasn't exploded, so.
I mean, I don't think you can actually reasonably choose who would be a better president between Barack Obama and Donald Trump. I mean, the choice is, like, very obvious. I don't see how anyone would think Donald Trump would be an effective president
I thought you were going for Donald Trump there.
Yeah, I was like, what?
No, I wasn't. I loathe the man.
It's like asking to choose between Snooki and Hillary Clinton. And at this point,
dear.
I kind of, like, choose Snooki. Like, over Hillary Clinton.
See, there you go. Hmm. I mean, once upon a time, Ronald Reagan was seen as a dangerous fringe candidate.
Yeah, wasn't he like, you know, second banana to a monkey or something on like a television show?
No, he had Bedtime for Bonzo.
Oh, I don't know.
As it later became Bedtime for Brezhnev.
But the point is, these things change. I mean, I know 4 years before he was elected president, before Abraham Lincoln was elected president, the Republican Party was a anti-slavery fringe party in American politics. I mean, things change. Things can change quickly depending on the mood of the American people.
True,
but looking at this anti-establishment with both Senator Sanders and Mr. Trump and Dr. Carson, getting huge shares of the vote, I mean, I'm starting to wonder if we're going to go into a brokered convention. That's a real possibility, because most of the people who are in it with substantial amounts of the vote are not going to drop out. Ted Cruz didn't drop out the last time.
Gosh, I wish.
Yeah, as a Texan, I want to apologize for Ted Cruz. Just, I'm just putting it out there.
Or as a Canadian. One or the other.
Canadian? Oh, that's right, yeah. Yeah, forgot about that.
All right, well, so we
My
all agree.
My family comes from Canada.
So all five of us across the political spectrum, from fascism to communism, agree on Donald Trump being a reprehensible human being. This is interesting.
I don't think there's a whole lot of debate there.
That's been Donald Trump's calling card for decades.
All right, well.
He's true to himself. Give him credit for that.
Well, let's look at this national security debate that Chris Christie has decided to unload upon Rand Paul. So Chris Christie wants, Chris Christie essentially wanted the resumption of the NSA security programs and criticized everybody on the stage who disposed with them after the Paris attacks. I think that's an interesting argument. Is anyone here a statist?
What?
I mean, if you're a left winger, you're a statist. And a fascist, I suppose. So.
Yeah, I mean,
sit back now, bide my time.
They aren't necessarily complete opposites. But
they're just
different.
No, they aren't,
Mr. Payne. Yeah. No, they aren't.
But no, Orvija, what do you think of this?
What?
Of the what Chris Christie said about the NSA.
I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the NSA is an organization that should minimize its operations entirely. So.
But what would you say to the section, to the espionage section of the Chinese military? I'll play devil's advocate for a minute. I mean, they have active espionage and sabotage operations going on against the United States, allegedly.
China doesn't pretend to be a democracy, though.
So you're saying that all democracies should roll over for fascism? I mean, that didn't seem to work out very well about 70 years ago.
I mean, if as a state you're saying that one of your main foundations of your country is, like, transparency and, like, democracy and all of that, then why do you need to have...
Isn't a democracy. The Constitutional Convention took place in secret, and it wasn't even supposed to decide on a new form of government. It was supposed to amend the Articles of Confederation. To be fair, I agree kind of with your point, but to be fair...
And also, when does, like, true and pure democracy really work out? I mean, like, they tried that in Athens.
And then they talked about a tree for 90 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
Hours.
Then they kill Socrates. That's what happens. Democracy kills Socrates.
But, you know. Well, Socrates probably deserved to be killed, but...
Did you just...
I mean, it is valid that definitely, kind of, these NSA programs are... do kind of go against kind of the basic American value of you're innocent until you're proven guilty, which isn't necessarily a democratic thing, but it's an American thing. And there is kind of due process of law is very much an American kind of ideal and embodied in our Constitution, and that these NSA programs do not follow upon this idea, and there are kind of serious kind of issues of terrorism and kind of espionage and such things that we do need to address, but it needs to respect the rights of American citizens, and that tends to be where I draw the line. I mean, if you're an American citizen, then your rights should not be violated by the government in any way. If you are not, well, you're not
sucks
an American
to be.
Citizen, sorry.
I mean, doesn't it all come down to transparency in proportion to power? Like, if you're as powerful as you are as, like, the United States, you should maintain a certain level of transparency. You can do that a certain...
The United States does, to be fair. I mean, if you compare the United States to the other kind of secondary powers of the world, like China and Russia, the United States is much more transparent than those two countries.
I mean, China and Russia aren't exactly good comparisons for transparency in the first place.
No, but the argument was about power. Your level of power should equal the level of transparency. And the British Empire, in the same way, attempted to kind of be kind of proper and upfront as it conducted its business. The Roman Empire saw itself as kind of the world's policeman amongst kind of these criminal rabbles on its borders. The most powerful country in the world does indeed attempt to promote kind of the status quo of kind of a system of rules. It wants everything to be calm because it wants to maintain its own power. That is true.
Okay, so we're running actually up on time. It's 6:59 and some change seconds right now. So this is our penultimate episode of the iteration of Talking Heads. Our final program will be next week, and all five of us will be here to yell at one another, as we always are, and from there, that point on, a new program will probably develop out of this. But next week, we'll probably be talking about the economy, the election as we wind into a close, and we'll be hitting on, as we always do, all the big international and national stories of the week as it stands. Oh, of course, and Donald Trump. We have to have Donald Trump. But so far, I mean, that's the way the world looks this week. It is this is Friday, and So I'm Matt McCord. I've been here with several of my guests. Again, we'll be here next week. But until next week, that's all we have time for tonight. See you at 6 o'clock next Friday, and have a great weekend, and thank you for listening.